on time for once today.
That's okay, I can't complain about that.
Yeah, I know, I mean, we got here within 5 minutes.
That's good, that's good.
So I wasn't like super, so I'm not super late.
Yeah, no, no.
Like, what, a couple weeks ago, I think? Didn't come to like, I didn't go to the meeting with me. Like that.
Hey, it's not just you, everybody gets impacted by the silliness in the city.
I know.
All right, so I procrastinated. I held things off, hoping that we'd have more people show up, but it's what it is. I want to go back to this because I kind of rushed it at the end because I realized I was running out of time. And again, this is something that's rather complicated, but again, it's important that you realize that laws just don't happen. And the reason why laws just don't happen is our founding fathers realized, again, they were very wise, that the worst decisions are made rashly.
And I'm sure the same is true in your own life. If you just react really quick and just make the impulse decision, oftentimes it creates more problems. So the whole intention of this system was to slow things down. Why? Well, it gives more people a chance to have eyes on it. It gives more people a chance to have a say. In other words, in the end, to produce the best laws possible. Now, of course, that's an ideal sense. Does partisan politics play a role? Yeah, unfortunately. These are the times in which we live. The Democrats ram things through because they are in charge of our state. Just like in other states, the Republicans ram things through because they are in charge. But in the ideal sense, the process would be slow, open, and transparent. So as we said, going all the way back to the beginning, all laws start with petitions. And any citizen in Massachusetts can file a petition. You get 10 votes on it, and you can put forward the request for a law. The petition, however, has to be signed off on, if you are just a normal citizen, by a member of either chamber, the House or the Senate. If it's a member of the Senate that signs onto it, it cannot involve money. All spending bills have to originate in the House. The best path forward is to get sponsors from both chambers. Get your senator and your representative to sign on. Once it is submitted, before it goes anywhere, the House and the Senate Committees on Rules have to make the rules for the bill. And as I said, the rules are just like the process, the timetable. It identifies which committees it has to go to. It identifies whether if there's funding, if it has to go to Ways and Means. It's all detailed out, kind of like the instructions. So they're not rules like laws, they're rules like instructions for that particular piece of legislation. If it doesn't involve spending, it then begins the process. It begins in whichever chamber the petition came from. And last time we did the hypothetical following the Senate path. Said it was not a funding bill. So it will be presented to the Senate. A copy, of course, will be submitted to the House. That does not mean both chambers work on it at the same time. That is typically not the case. Typically, the chamber where it starts is where it goes through the process. The only time they work together, as we're going to see today when we talk about the committees, the various committees that are in our legislature, there's like 30 of them, the vast majority of them are joint committees. And as I mentioned, about 150 years ago, our legislature realized it made no sense to have separate committees each hearing the same bill. That would just take more time. So it would be more efficient, streamlined, to have both listed together. Thank you. On each of the committees, you have representatives of the House and the Senate. during the hearings, I wrote it on the board. That's when the bill is marked up. They write comments. They write their suggestions. Because during the committees is when they bring the outside people in. The hearings are open to the public. As I mentioned, you can go and testify if you want to. I did. It's cool. It really is. I mean, again, in a real, true, nerdy sense, you know, you hear about it all your life. Well, we live in a democracy. We live in a democracy. But how many people actually get involved? Well, you have the ability. You go to Beacon Hill, you go into one of these committees, you can testify before the committee. Although the part, I told you, right, the part that pissed me off the most was the clock. It gave me 3 minutes. They had like a 27-inch TV. No, it's bigger than that, like a 72-inch TV on the wall. It had a countdown clock. And you're sitting there like, I got so much I want to say, and you're like, blah, 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 because you're watching the clock. You're focused on the clock, not your words. Luckily, when I had to go back for my bill the second time, it was early enough, and the chairwoman basically said, don't worry about the clock, just, we know you're here again, just tell us why you're back. So that was more relaxed, and I was actually able to do questions. So, you know, that felt good. But if it's something you are passionate about, you have the ability to do this. Any citizen does. Well, once the hearings are closed, again, it goes back into the committee meetings and they mark up the proposed law. And then it goes back to the chamber it originates in. Why? Well, if the committee votes in a majority in favor of the bill, it's going to go before the full chambers for hearings. But there has to be what's known as three readings. In the first meeting, the bill is read to the body. And the body, all 40 senators, all 160 representatives, have the ability to comment on the bill. Some choose not to talk, and they just are in favor of it, or they're against it. Some want to add amendments to it. Some want to change the language. The body is allowed to do that. Of course, once the body hears it, if it has money, it's got to get diverted and go to Ways and Means. Ways and Means literally assesses the cost-benefit analysis of the bill. Is the bill affordable? Is there a way to fund the bill? Is the bill going to be a one-time expense, or is it going to be a reoccurring item? If the Ways and Means rejects it, the bill is dead. The only way the bill can continue forward if money's involved is if Ways and Means approves. Then, once it gets out, it goes back on the calendar. Why? Because you're going to have a second reading before the whole body. Here is the amended bill. Here is all the amendments that get added to it. They're called riders. If it is generally approved, it then goes to a specialized committee called Bills on Reading. And by the way, when we're done, we're going to talk about the joint committees. We'll talk about Ways and Means. We'll talk about rules. We'll talk about bills, committee on the bills in the third reading. They are your friendly editors. The committee on the bills on the third reading. They review every word, every clause, every sentence that's in the bill. They make sure that references to other laws are accurate. They're finalizing it. Then once it's done, it goes back to the Senate floor for a third reading, where the members vote. If the bill gets a majority vote, it's considered to be passed. And it's finalized, it's locked in. No more changes to the Senate version can occur. It then goes to the printers, where it's engrossed. This is kind of like where I started having to speed up real quick. Engrossment simply means the bill, the Senate version, in its finalized form, is put on official Senate stationery. They have a particular type of paper that it's put on. It's stamped. It's signed by the printer. Then, because our hypothetical bill started in the Senate, then the Senate version goes all the way back to the House. And the process begins again. Now here's the thing. Both chambers, again, bicameralism. This is the reason why bicameralism is important. You have two chambers, and you could essentially end up with two completely different proposals, two versions. That is allowed. Because there's nothing saying the House has to accept the Senate version. They could want to do their own version. Or they could simply fast-track the Senate version through. Well, the Senate version comes to the House and the House debates it. Chances are the representatives are not going to be satisfied with what the Senate did. They're going to want to have their own opinion on it. So they're going to add amendments and riders and changes and alterations. That will essentially become the House version. If there's money, it goes to Ways and Means. If Ways and Means votes in the affirmative, then it goes to the House again for a second reading. If there is no money, it just goes to the floor. Members then will vote on locking it up. What do we think? Are we in favor of this? And what? From there, it goes to the House version of the Committee of Bills in the third reading. I's are dotted, T's are crossed, grammar's checked, everything's cross-referenced. It's locked down, and it goes to the floor for a final vote. If the Senate version is changed, even if one letter is changed, you have a separate House bill. Almost there. Hold off. Don't get eager, my audience. The House approves, it then gets printed on the right paper. But now you have a situation where you have two separate bills, Senate version and the House version. It could be, generally speaking, talking about the same item, but they could be completely different. So how do you reconcile it? Well, they have to be merged together. The merger takes place in the third of the four committees, or fourth of the five committees that I'm going to want you to know. It's called a conference committee. Unlike Ways and Means, bills in the third meeting, and the joint committees, those are called standing committees. Meaning they're always there. They're always operational. But the conference committee is something special. A conference committee is created just to reconcile, just to merge the two versions of the bills together. So in essence, this means for every bill, there is a separate conference committee that only meets so long as it takes to blend the bills. Once There is one bill. One bill. Ready for this one? It goes back to the chambers again for one last vote. Why? Well, what happens if the merger isn't liked? But if it's approved, it then goes to the general court in Grousing office. The merged bill is put on official general court stationery. It gets an official general court number. Not a House version, not a Senate version. Now it is the general court bill. It then, all bills, whether it started in the center of the House, first goes to the Speaker's desk. And the Speaker of the House signs it. Once the Speaker signs it, it then goes to the Senate. Where the Senate President signs it. And if both sign it, it then goes to the governor's desk. Question. Does the governor have to sign every piece of legislation that comes across her desk? No. What may she do? What may the governor do if she does not want to sign a bill? She could veto it. What does that mean? Yes. She doesn't like the version of veto. But here's the catch. She just can't say no. Even if she just wants to say no. She has to qualify her veto. Which simply means she has to write a statement saying why she is against it. Or she can propose a change. She can amend the bill. She does nothing. Well, I suppose I'll give you that. If she signs it, obviously it becomes a law. If she signs a bill into law, it goes into effect in 90 days. Why 90 days? Well, that gives the Supreme Judicial Court a chance to basically decide whether the law is constitutional or not. If she does nothing, does not sign, it automatically becomes law in 10 days and then goes into effect in 90 days thereafter. Why is this the case? Well, going back to John Adams, they did not want to give our governor a chance to be a coward, to try to stonewall. This forces the governor's hand. You're either for it or you're against it. And if you're against it, you have to tell us why. All right. What happens if these two situations occur? What happens if the governor vetoes it? What happens if the governor amends it? Well, here's the interesting thing. It goes back to the general court. Because what can the general court do to the governor's veto or amendment? Anybody know? They can override it. If the governor vetoes the bill, if the governor amends the bill, the legislature does not have to agree. They can actually override the veto and pass what they wanted to begin with. But here's the catch. In order to override a governor's veto, it requires a two-thirds vote in both chambers. It requires a two-thirds vote in both chambers. Now here's the thing. In Massachusetts, we have a one-party state, and the majority party has a supermajority. So basically, if they're just going to act in a partisan way, the D's versus the R's, the D's have the ability to override any veto that the governor may make. Now, here's the weird thing. When we had Charlie Baker as governor, Republican, the legislature did override two of his vetoes. But his predecessor was a Democrat, a man by the name of Deval Patrick. Deval Patrick was not a liberal progressive Democrat. He was actually kind of a conservative Democrat. And so he vetoed a couple of the bills that came out. Well, the legislature overrode his vetoes as well. The unfortunate reality is in our state, being a one-party state, the majority party can basically do whatever it wants. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just reality. Question. Now, do all states follow this process? Basically. There aren't too many states that the process is any quicker than what we have. The only thing that may be different is the names of the committees might be different. And the same is true in Congress. So if you've ever saw Schoolhouse Rocks, I'm just a bill, it's basically the same process. No questions.
All right. Let's go. Where is it? There it is. Let's go to our homework.
rushing and running out of time. I responded to your email, right?
I don't think
so. Oh, all right. I apologize.
But you got it?
I got both of them, yeah. All right. So, last class, I asked you to do this over the weekend. FYI, if you did one or the other homeworks, guess what your questions are going to be, essay questions on your next exam. I'm literally going to take them from this. So if you've done it, and I have them, you don't have to... Yes. No. If you did it, and I have it, and I've graded it, you don't have to answer the essays. I'll just give you those 10 points right there. If you did not do these, I'm going to pick some questions off of both, and that's what you're going to have to answer for your essays on the exam. Yes, you submitted that one, you did not do this one. Unless you sent it to me and I didn't see it.
So when we do the test, do we just like skip the question?
You can just skip the question. I'm just going to plug the grade. Alright, so let's do this real quick. All of these, like I said, could be answered in a single question. For, oh, by the way, if you did not do it, I would suggest that you write these down because I'm giving you the answers. Man, am I a nice professor. All right. What are the names of each branch that make up the general court? Senate and the House of Representatives. Very good. All right, wait. I'm going to amend that. Did you do your homework already? Did you just email it to me? Email it to me right now. I'm not going to answer any questions before it's in my inbox. Now let me know when you send it.
Give me a chance to take a swig of coffee. Good? And you sent in my Quinn Sig one, right?
Jalen Mack at Quinn Sig, whatever it is. Send it to my personal one or my Quinn Sig one?
You know, I can't check my Quinn Sig one.
Send it though, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Why are there two branches in the general court? Checks and balances. That's it. Checks and balances. Easy. How does a bill, according to the Constitution, become a law? What does the Constitution actually say? Anyone answer this?
I think that a bill is first passed by both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and both branches have to approve it and send it to the governor.
If the governor approves it and signs it, the bill becomes a law.
Yeah, literally, that's what it says in the Constitution. Perfect. All right, what happens if the bill, or the resolve, as it's referred to in the Constitution, is objected to in its current form? What does the Constitution say? Anybody? It's in there. It's like the second clause of the part of the first, section one.
So, if the government does not agree with the bill, it is to return to the branch where originally started, along with the government's written objections, explaining why it was rejected.
And then they can override it. Okay. That was probably the longest answer that we're looking for. Well, actually, that's there. Can the general court do anything about the objection? Yes, they can override it. Two-thirds vote. All right, what role does the general court have in the creation of the courts and the powers of each court? What does the Constitution say? We did cover this in class. They make it. With the exception of the SJC, it's the job of the general court, they pass a law, and they make the courts. And in that law, they can create the jurisdiction. Which means that if the court's not operating, what can the general court do? If the law creates a court, and the court's not doing what it's supposed to do, what can the general court do? The legislature. Could they not pass another law and change the court? Or could they not pass another law and eliminate the court? That's part of the oversight powers of our legislature. And I know I'm saying court a lot, but courts of law as opposed to the general court. Remember, our legislature is called the general court. All right, according to the Constitution, what are the five types of laws that can be made? Or named five. There was more. There's a whole bunch of different laws that could be passed. Five types.
Taxes.
What?
Taxes.
They can pass a law dealing with taxes. They can make the courts. Doesn't the legislature have the power to say you cannot engage in a certain type of behavior? If the government says you cannot engage in a certain type of behavior, what do we call that? What type of law? If you stab somebody with a knife, you are committing a crime. Yeah, you pass criminal laws. What other type of laws can they pass? They can define military powers. They can muster a militia. They could fund it. They could pick leaders, yes. I need just one more.
Regulation of town and local governments.
They can regulate town and local governments, yeah. Very good, very good. Questions on any of those first up? All right, seeing none. According to the Constitution, how many persons, that was the word that was used in there, make up the Senate? 40, very good. Ooh. Voting qualifications. Remember when we talked about the foundation of the province of Massachusetts Bay, any freeman could vote. But the catch was, they originally had to be part of the Congregational Church, and they had to be sponsored by somebody that was in the Congregational Church. So they had to be voted on and approved. Well, when the province of Massachusetts was made, the second charter, they eliminated that religious test. And they put in other requirements. Some of those requirements remained in place and are reflected in the original pre-amended constitution. What were the qualifications to vote? If you wanted to vote for someone running for Senate, according to the Constitution. What must you have? What must you be? You had to live in the district that you were voting. That's a big qualification. You had to be a dude. Was there an age requirement in there? 21 and older. Why 21 and older? Why not 25? Why not 17? Why 21? Yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? Why 21? You know, they're actually on that, there is no answer. There is no actual answer that can define why did they pick 21 as the age of majority. Don't know. That's just tradition. That's just the way it always was. All right, so you had to be a man, you had to be over 21, you had to live in the district that you voted. What's the other qualification?
Land ownership?
You had to own land. You had to own land. I think they had the valuation of pounds in there.
16.
What?
16.
Yeah. Oh, land worth 60 pounds, right?
Yeah.
All right. Why? I can understand. I don't understand why 21. I understand why you have to live in the district. I understand why you had to be a man. By the way, why did you have to be a man to vote? Why did they not let women vote? No. This goes back in time. In the English tradition, as was the tradition in Europe and many other cultures on earth, when the man married the woman, they had a legal status based on unity. In other words, they were unified. They became one. But the presumption was it was the man who was the public face of the family, because the man traditionally physically stronger. So the man essentially could protect the interests of the family. Now, I know our opinions have changed. I'm just telling you from a historical perspective. So basically, the woman was part of the family. And obviously, like any modern marriage, I'm sure the wives told their husbands what to do in many instances. Because men have always been men and women have always been women. But in terms of public relations, it was the man that was the public face. It was the man who owned the land. So because it was the man that was the public face, it was the man that was allowed to participate in the voting process. Is it perfect by today's standards? No. I'm not saying that in any way, shape, or form. But that's just the way it was. That was the perception. So we've covered that one. What about why own land? Why did you have to own land as a qualification to vote? If you own land today, what must you do? You have to pay taxes. You have to pay taxes. And if you are paying taxes, what are you doing by that act? What are taxes supposed to be used for? The common good, for the people. So the view of that generation was you only deserve a say if you contribute to society. If you did not own land and you did not pay taxes, you don't deserve to have a say. Because you contribute nothing to society as a whole. I'm not saying that you had no individual value or worth. But if you're not paying taxes, you're not paying it forward. You're not helping out the community. So if you're not helping the community, why should you have a say on how the community operates? I'll be honest with you. Haven't quite figured out the 21 thing yet. I understand why back then it was meant. I don't agree. But I understand it. Out of all the other standards living in the district, I get that one, and I'm in favor of that one. But this last point, I agree with that 100%. If you don't pay taxes in any form, I don't think you should vote. I know I'm in the minority on that. But I think it makes sense. All right. We got that. Under the pre-amended Constitution, what was the original length of senatorial terms? How long were they in office for?
1 year.
1 year. Yeah, 1 year.
Can't do much in a year.
Hmm?
Can't do much in a year.
No, you can't. No, you can't. But you know why they had 1 year? They wanted to give the people a chance to remove the bad legislators. So they were in favor of constant elections. We don't have that anymore. We'll talk about that next class. Can anyone run? Who can run for the Senate? What qualifications does the pre-amended Constitution establish for anyone wanting to run for Senate?
You have to at least be at least 30 years old.
Why do you think 30 years old? That's so young. Why 30?
Experience probably.
Yeah. The average life expectancy during this time was about 40. So if you lived to 30, you were viewed as having lived life. You experienced, which is the weird thing, because today they treat people who are like 25, 26 as kids. Back then, there was no concept of childhood. The moment you could work, you worked. The moment you could contribute to your family, you contributed to your family. You probably were either helping your family run the family farm or business, or you never know, you could be 15, 16, and dad could already be dead, and you could be running the farm. So by 30 years old, you've already experienced life. So you were perceived to have the capacity to be wise. Okay, 30, what else? Well, yeah, you had to be a man, yeah. Anything else?
Massachusetts.
You had to live in Massachusetts?
5 years.
5 years. Why did they want you living in Massachusetts for 5 years? Why didn't they just want to allow carpetbaggers to come in? Why five? Or why any period of time, let alone the exact number?
Because
Why not anyone who moves in? Why can't they just run? If you've never lived here before, what do you actually know about the district? So the expectation was, is if you're going to come here, anyone can move in, but before you can run, we want you here for a little while. Any other qualifications? What do you got?
The original constitution required them to meet certain property qualifications.
Same standards to vote. Same standards to vote. 21, male, live in the district, and have at least 60 pounds worth of land. Doesn't it make sense that if someone's going to be in the office, they have to be qualified to vote? Yeah? All right. Who's the chief officer in the Senate? What's the position called? President of the Senate. Very good. What role does the Senate play in the impeachment process? What role does the Senate play in the impeachment process? You got it?
I was scratching my
head. Oh, I thought you were putting it in. Anybody know? The Senate tries. The Senate holds the trial.
Like acts like a court.
Acts like a court, yep. So if someone is impeached, they go before the Senate and the Senate votes. Can the Senate, according to the Constitution, send somebody to jail? What's the only thing they can do during their trial? What's the only punishment they can impose?
Judge whether its members were properly elected?
Well, that's this one. That's the power that the Senate has over its members. What? Well, they can decide the outcome, so they can determine if someone's impeached or not. But what's the only punishment they can impose? They can't send someone to the gallows to be hung. What can they do? No. The only thing they can do is remove them from office. So if you are accused of wrongdoing and you are impeached and the Senate votes to impeach you, all they can do is pull you out of office. All right. And we did this one. What power does the Senate have? The Senate has the power to basically determine if someone's properly elected, and they can basically overview the behavior of their members. Questions on any of those?
Right, moving right along.
Last section. Ah, this is one thing that's very different today. Under the pre-amended Constitution, how many representatives are each town entitled? How many can they get? This was a change, a historical change, from the way it was originally. Originally, after the revolt of 1634, Governor Winthrop agreed to allow every community to have two representatives. And that remained in place through the provincial charter. But under the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, it had a different formula in there. What's the formula? Anybody find it?
Yes,
It's based on the size of the town.
Is it the 150 people or 150 voters vote in one representative?
If there's at least 150 voters, they get one representative.
And then if it's like bigger, it consists on the size.
If it's bigger, they can get more. Up to how many? Maximum. Maximum is 3. So the small towns get a representative. Medium-sized town gets 2 representatives. The big towns get 3. Why? Give more representatives to the larger communities. And we have to call them towns, because the first official city was Boston, and that wasn't created until about 50 years after Massachusetts was created. Why do the bigger towns get more representatives? It's not a trick question. Because there's more people. Yeah. Would it be fair if you had a town that had, say, 8,000 people, and you give them one representative, which would be the same representatives from a town of 50? No, you wouldn't get equal representation. So the idea behind this was if you had a bigger town, you could get more representatives. All right. This should be House. I screwed that up. That was a typo. But it's the same requirements. To vote, what do we need? You got to be a male. How old? 21. Where do you got to live? In the district, yep, in Massachusetts. And you have to own land. Okay, very good. What's the length of a house term?
1 year.
1 year. We've already said the same. By the way, guess what the term, as you're going to see for the next homework assignment after break, guess what the term of the governor was originally?
1 year.
1 year. 1 year. All right. To run for the House, what qualifications must you have? I'll help you out. Same basic qualifications to vote, plus live in Massachusetts for a year. Any age qualifications? 21. Why not make the House of Representatives have the same age as the Senate? Why allow a representative to be younger? How many senators are there? 40. How many representatives do you think there were? 90. I think at its height, because you're going to include Maine as well, I think the most representatives we've ever had was something like 850. So if you have 850 representatives, do you need to have every single member have lots of experience? No, the idea was you could have a mentorship, because the Senate was viewed as the upper chamber, the more elite. All right. Who's the chief officer in the House? We call that role what?
Speaker.
Speaker. Very good. What role does the House play in the impeachment process?
They bring a impeachments to stand.
They bring the impeachments. FYI, impeachment means, or rather to impeach, means what? Does anybody know what is involved in impeachment? What are you doing if you impeach somebody? Huh? No, it's not the removal. Removal is the consequence of the impeachment process. But being impeached is what?
Like a warning, just basically like
you're saying something that you're not supposed to. No. Well, babe, you are basically doing some. You get caught doing something you should not do. So, in order to be punished for a crime, what does the government have to do to you first? They have to accuse you. To be impeached means you are being accused of wrongdoing. So the job of the House is essentially just to point the finger and say, you're doing wrong. If the House impeaches you, it's up to the Senate to decide whether you actually did what it is you were accused of doing. By the way, the same is true on the United States government level as well. There have been many impeachments in our nation's history, but four of the impeachments have involved sitting presidents. President Johnson, who succeeded Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson. President William Jefferson Clinton. And President Donald J. Trump.
What about Nixon?
Nixon was never impeached.
Okay.
Nixon did not want to put the country through the trial.
Okay.
So he resigned.
So who was the fourth?
Trump was twice.
Oh! Sorry, I only forget once.
No, that's all right. In all of those cases, the House accused, but not once did the Senate convict. There have been, however, members of the cabinet, judges, and other officials in our nation's history that have been impeached and accused of wrongdoing, found guilty by the Senate. But there's never been a president. Massachusetts? I do not know. I do not know of any governor that was ever impeached. The process is there. But I will get back to you on that one when we get to the governor's section. All right. What unique power does the House possess that the Senate does not? Now, that's the involvement in the impeachment process.
How many questions I have?
We're on 21.
Sorry, I labeled them as 1, 2,
3. That's all right, we did 1, 2, 3, but we're on 21 right now. What's the one area that the House has authority over that the Senate does not? No, not the impeachment. The money. Anything dealing with money. The House has the power of the purse. Anything dealing with taxing or spending, the bill has to start in the House. Why? Because that goes back to the Sons of Liberty. No taxation without representation. And last but not least, what power does the House have over its own?
Properly, and qualified for office, and then also expelled.
They can determine if the election for the members are proper. And if the member misbehaves, the House has the ability to expel its members, just like the Senate. All right, very good, very good. So if you have hard copies, I'll take your hard copies. If you've got a digital, just you should have sent it to me already. And for those of you who did not get it done, you got all the answers, so you will be able to answer the questions. Just whip it out when you're sitting there taking your exam, and you can answer the questions that I put there for you.
I'm not going to put it all, but I'm not going to do that. What I'll do is I'll pick like two questions from each section. All right, so we did all this. We did this. All right. Any questions on that assignment?
By the way, for those of you who did it, thank you. I mean, it's really important. I can get up here and I can go like this. But until you actually sit back, take the time and actually read, you know, it's good for you to see it in your own eyes.
All right, so kind of bouncing around on things, committee system. All right, I guess we'll
I'll give you like 5 more minutes and then we'll call it a class.
All right. Oh, by the way, I should say this right now. We're at the point where I'm ready to give you the second exam. I need one more class.
So I know we got spring break next week. So what I want to do is basically I want to give you a second exam at any day up till Sunday. So that way you can have your full week off of spring break. So I just want you to think about it. We'll make a decision next class. I'm assuming you're probably all going to want like Sunday again, which is fine with me. And it will be on Blackboard again. So it'll be basically the same format.
All right, legislative organization. Legislative organization. As we know, we have two chambers. We have the Senate and the House of Representatives. By the way, the same is true in almost every single legislature in the country. The only exception, I think, is Nebraska?
I think Nebraska has a unicameral state legislature. They only have one chamber. I'm pretty sure all the rest of them have two.
Why? We've already covered it. Checks and balances. All right. As far as the size, today, the size of the Senate remains the same, 40 members. But the House has been shrunk. From its high point, I apologize, the high point was 748, not 800. I had it wrong. Since 1978, the House has been made up of 160 members. So the total number of the general court combined, we have 200 members, 40 senators, 160 representatives. To serve in the Senate today, it still pretty much remains the same. You have to be qualified to vote. And by the way, today, what are the qualifications to vote?
You have to be 18, right? And you have to vote in the town where what?
Where you reside.
Where you reside. Okay, very good. So to be a senator, you have to be at least 18. You have to live. They eliminate the age qualification. You have to live in the district in which you reside.
But the 5-year requirement remains.
The 5-year requirement remains. For the same basic idea. Yes? Yes, unless you re-register. So, I grew up in Northbridge. I went to school when I was an undergrad out at UMass in Amherst. I was just enraptured with the idea of voting. I graduated high school young. I was 17, turned 18 when I was out of college. So the first thing I did when I turned 18 was I registered to vote, and the address I put was my dorm. So that meant I couldn't vote in any town elections, but I could vote in the Amherst elections. But when I was done with college and I went back home for like 2 months, I re-registered, but then I moved to Worcester, so then I had to re-register again. It was a pain in the ass.
Where did you dorm?
Well, I was in Southwest. I was in John Adams. All right. Senate.
40 members have to live in the district at least 5 years, qualified to vote.
And today, two-year terms. Two-year terms, not one. Two-year terms.
And FYI, the senatorial district is based on population.
Give or take. Each senator has a district of about 160,000 people. So if you look at the map, the senatorial maps, senators have multiple towns in their district. So my senator, Ryan Fatman, his district, I think, stretches from Milford all the way out to Munson.
To be a representative, 160 members,
two-year term, live in the district for 1 year, qualified voter. But because there are four times as many representatives, their districts are roughly one-fourth the size, population-wise, as the Senate. So you can look up your own representative, but my representative is Joe McKenna. He lives in Sutton, and his district is Sutton, half of Oxford, Webster, Douglas, and either part of Northbridge or Uxbridge. A little slice of it. It's bizarre. Because you know how the districts are made. We're going to talk about this when we do elections. The general court takes the map of the state and they do what's called gerrymandering. They just basically make districts up. But our laws require them to be roughly equal in population. All right, that's good enough. I'm not going over late today. So, any questions? All right, so we're going to come back. We're going to kind of finish up our discussion on the legislature. Again, you're going to get an exam before Sunday, and then we will be halfway done the class. Just a couple of things to throw out. Keep in mind, you also have a paper that's due. That's not due until the beginning of May, but I did give you an early submission date, which I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. I think it was sometime in April. So if you have time over spring break, maybe that's something you want to do. Paper's not that long, just bang it out. Thank you for those of you who participated today. I will see you all on Thursday.